KALW.
Therapy is not going to be a constant thing. That's a human. They have their own life. AI is always there for you.
Some teens are turning to artificial intelligence for therapy.
My number one reason for downloading an app is because professional help is so expensive.
Mental health tech support. Then we meet the Bay Area Olympic swimmer who's not competing on Team USA.
If I can make a semifinal and kind of represent Sudan on the final stage in the Olympics, I think that would be like perfect scenario for me.
And a novel set in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood gets real about some of the challenges teens face today.
But I wanted to see a book that was set in Fruitvale that was about Latina girls that I hadn't seen before.
Plus, we get a reading from our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Here at KALW, bringing new voices to public radio is at the heart of what we do. We run training programs and sometimes work with other educators to reach more people in different spaces. In collaboration with San Jose's Mosaic Summer Journalism Program, we supported teenagers who wanted to make their stories come to life through audio and the spoken word. This one is from American high school student Nanki Carr. Nanki got curious and concerned when she started hearing that her classmates were turning to programs like ChatGPT for mental health support. She set out to learn more. Here she is.
For many teenagers, digital tools that use artificial intelligence, or AI, have become a go-to option for emotional support.
Downloading an app was definitely an easier, helpful way out. Because when you're like depressed and stuff, it gets really hard to take care of yourself. And sometimes you do have to explain yourself to people, and that's not always an easy thing to do.
Dwija Kothari is going to be a senior at American High in Fremont. She uses the Fabulous app for mental health support and actually prefers it over in-person therapy.
First of all, therapy is not going to be a constant thing. They're not going to be with you all the time. Like, that's a human. They have their own life. AI is, it's always there for you.
Many apps use AI to create a reminder system to track our daily habits.
With therapy, I feel like it's not going to tell you to get out of bed, or it's not going to tell you to eat food or go shower or go brush your teeth.
Downloading free apps that utilize AI mental health support seems to be common among teenagers in the Bay Area, as they learn to navigate and cope in a world where there are barriers to getting mental health care. AI is an easy and inexpensive choice.
My number one reason for downloading an app is because professional help is so expensive.
Luz Campuzano is the senior recreation leader at the Alum Rock Youth Center in San Jose. She works with teens daily.
A lot of them talk about the stresses of school and not feeling like they're listened to. A lot of them come to the teen center because they don't want to go home. I really think being a teen is the hardest thing.
She thinks the appeal of using AI for mental health support has a lot to do with control and isn't surprised by this new coping mechanism.
It's easier, right? Just like, I don't have to tell my parents. They don't want to tell their parents that they need help, especially in the Latino community in this area. Very like, they shy away from that. They want to be able to go places that they can't. They want to do things that they can't, and their parents won't let them. The teachers talk to them a certain way.
Though it offers control, Campuzano does have concerns with AI.
The human experience, I don't think it can fully replace it, because the AI is not going to know your story, is not going to tell you their own experience, speak on their own experiences. It's just going to kind of tell you what you want to hear.
Dr. Preet Sabharwal, a clinical psychologist at the Hume Center in Fremont, thinks AI could be beneficial to teenagers.
Having access to technology has really helped this next generation be more mindful of their mental health, because those conversations are being normalized.
But relying on a robot when you're at your most vulnerable, is it a good idea?
Mental health challenges come with a level of risk when we start thinking about those that are in extreme isolation, engaging in therapy in their home that may open up their access to care, it may not be the right modality for them to engage in services because their isolation is a part of their symptomology and this is just going to perpetuate that isolation. We also are afraid that, especially with youth that may be experiencing some suicidal ideation or have used self-harm in the past, not being seen in person in a clinic could actually increase that level of suicidal ideation.
I'm Nanki Kaur for Cross Currents.
That story was reported as part of the Mosaic Summer Journalism Program. This fall, she'll be a senior at American High in Fremont. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Ziad Salim is a Sudanese-American student at UC Berkeley, and he's competing in the Summer Olympics, but not for Team USA. Salim is swimming for Sudan, a country that has sent swimmers to the Olympics before. But these games, it's a different reality. Sudan is in the middle of a war with 8 million people displaced. So this year, athletes representing Sudan are either refugees or members of the diaspora. And one of them is Salim, a rising senior at UC Berkeley. Between being a student and an athlete, it was hard to catch him for an interview, but a small window opened up and I caught up with him on the phone in my car right before he left for Paris.
What's your first memory of swimming?
I think my first memory would be like in the water, just me and my dad. After my swim lessons, it'd just be me and him in the water, working on my different strokes and how I'm pulling in the water. And I think I was probably like 4 or 5 at the time. So that's probably my earliest memory, just me and him working, telling me about my breathing and all the little things I'm doing wrong and how I can try to improve.
When did it turn into something more than that for you?
I had done all the levels and I started repeating levels. And then one lifeguard who was my coach was like, I think you should try out competitive swimming. Like, just try it out. So then at 6, I went and then started swim lessons at like my local competitive team. And then I think ever since then, I kind of had an edge for it. I was pretty good at like 8, 9, 10, and then just continued onward.
What does it feel like being in the water? Can you describe it?
When I'm in the water, it's just me and myself. So I think all the other external things I'm focusing on, like the stress of school or other things I'm worrying about, I think that all kind of goes away. And it's just me in the water and just focusing on like whatever little thing I'm trying to work on that day. So I think it's really mentally clearing. And it kind of gives me a big like hour and a half, 2 hour break in my day to really just be focused in on what I'm doing in the water and kind of remove myself from all the external factors that I'm like stresses that I have in my day-to-day life.
How did you get from that to today going to the Olympics?
I'd say, I don't know. I was pretty good like 11, 12. Like I was winning like some state titles and stuff here and there. So I was always pretty good. And then I'd say 15, like 16, I took a little jump. Like, and then we were kind of talking about like trying to go to college for swimming. Had a really good senior year. And then that's kind of where I was able to like come to Cal, which is like one of the best swimming schools in the nation. And yeah, I think that from then on, I think that's kind of where the opportunity came, yeah.
And so what are you studying at Cal?
Financial economics.
You're studying in a field, but you're also this incredible athlete. How do you see your life then? Like, how do you make the two work together?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing my dad taught me was like swimming's only take you, I don't know, 20, maybe 20 till I'm 22, 23. Like, so I still have my whole life where I need to focus on my field and all this other stuff. So I think that was a big thing my dad really instilled in me. So there's still a big focus on the school aspect and just learning and trying to get my career set up. But also there's a big focus on trying to swim fast and be as great as an athlete as possible.
So you chose to swim for Sudan, not Team USA. Why?
For me, it was just like swimming for, you know, where my parents are from was really important. And also like having the opportunity to travel to these big meets and like have the opportunity to go to the Olympics and different world championships. With Sudan, I was able, not guarantee, but I had a lot better chance of going to these international meets rather than if I'm on the US team, then I have one meet to qualify and it's a lot more stress of trying to make the different teams. But so with Sudan, I was more excited to really represent the country and also be able to swim at Olympics and other world championships.
We're talking now and there's a big Sudan flag behind you. What's your tie to Sudan as a place, as a culture, as a people?
I mean, I'd say I'm a little distant because I haven't really lived there my whole life. So I've been in Milwaukee a lot, but we visited maybe 5-6 times in my life. So I've been there quite a few times. I think with the culture, we're really intact with the Sudanese community, like in Milwaukee and stuff. So really connected there. And I'm also connected, I think, ethnically, like food-wise. Like my mom always makes different types of foods.
What's your favorite Sudanese food?
I have to say probably gurasa.
Gurasa?
Yeah.
So gurasa, okay, for our listeners, gurasa is like a pancake, I would say, but savory.
Yeah.
And we eat it with a stew. And there are many kinds of stews that we call them mulahat.
Yep.
So what mulah would you like in your like fantasy of a gurasa right now?
I don't know the name of it, but it's like that kind of red one.
The reddish brown.
Yes, that's
a favorite
one. Yeah.
Mulah tagaliya. Sudanese American going to the Olympics, swimming for Sudan. You've been getting a lot of attention. What kind of reactions have you been getting from the Sudanese community or the Sudanese people?
The biggest thing was, I mean, a couple months ago, I swam in African Championships and I was able to win 2 golds and a silver and hear the anthem, the Sudanese anthem for the first time. So I think that really was probably the biggest thing. I think a lot of people reached out saying, like on Instagram and Facebook, saying they were crying because they heard the anthem for the first time. So it was a really big deal.
And your family, what's their reaction right now? You are going to the Olympics and you're swimming for their country, which also, as we know, is going through a terrible time right now with war in Sudan. Hearing the news about you and following you in the Olympics, it's a big moment for a lot of people. But what does it mean for you?
Yeah, I think for me, there's pressure, obviously. But I think for me, it's just trying to do my best. And I think for me, if I can make a semifinal and kind of represent Sudan in a final stage in the Olympics, I think that would be like a perfect scenario for me.
What would that make you feel if you're standing up there and you've made it and it's the Sudan flag and it's the Sudan anthem?
I don't know what could happen in the future, but maybe I'm not doing it. It could be a long time for this to happen again. So it's just taking it in and really enjoying the moment.
We will be watching.
Thank you.
No pressure.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's UC Berkeley student and Olympic swimmer Ziad Salim. He'll be competing in the 200-meter backstroke this Wednesday, July 31st, hoping to make the semifinals. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The young adult novel, Shut Up, This Is Serious, takes readers into Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood. The story follows two Latina teenagers. One is pregnant and her parents are racist towards her Black boyfriend. The other is grappling with an absent father and a neglectful mother. The story is full of hardship and love. Author Carolina Ixta is from Oakland and the daughter of Mexican immigrants. She spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
Carolina, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy you're here because I am so excited about this book. As I was telling you before the interview, I went to high school in the Fruitvale, still go there. So it's definitely home for me. So to see a teenager, a Latina teenager in the Fruitvale at the Wendy's that I used to go to when I was in high school, like, I was just so excited about this setting and this story. Okay, so you've lived throughout Oakland, the East Bay. Why did you want your book to take place in the Fruitvale?
I think Fruitvale, of all of the places where I grew up in my childhood, I have the most memories being in Fruitvale. My mom worked for Oakland Unified School District as a principal, a teacher for a long time. And so even though we had moved so much, I spent so much time in that community. My dad's family lived on like East 17th and Foothill. And when I thought about writing the book, I was an undergrad. I was very homesick. And I was thinking about how there are so many stories that are set in Oakland, but very few that specifically name Fruitvale. The only one I could think of was Fruitvale Station. And a lot of the stories that were set in East Oakland had to do with like unfortunate like police brutality and community violence. And I knew that that had to be a part of my book, but I wanted to see a book that was set in Fruitvale that was about Latina girls that I hadn't seen before, and a book that like gave a very robust understanding of Oakland as a place that, yes, definitely can be violent, but also was like what it was for my family, like a very welcoming community and a very beautiful place to grow up.
She's not perfect. Just reading her, the dialogue, it's just, I stood at that bus stop that she stood at. Mm-hmm. I know how it felt standing at that bus stop and men harassing you and catcalling you. And she's dealing with a lot. Her father left the family.
Yeah.
So she's skipping class. Mm-hmm. So she might not graduate high school. She's a senior. There's so many issues you brought up in the book that I'm really glad that you raised. And one thing is Belen's body and how we treat curvy, especially curvy girls of color, and sexualizing them, and how some of the people in her community, her family, that first of all, there's shaming, you know, like fat shaming or whatever. And also, too, just because she's curvy, this assumption that she's promiscuous.
Right.
And I love that you put that in there because I thought about her standing on that corner and how men would look at her and think like, oh, because she's curvy, that she's inviting sexual attention. Talk about that and why did you have that in the book? I was really glad that you addressed that.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, going back to like the fat shaming and fat phobia, anyone who grows up in a very traditional like Latino, Latina family, especially women, you know, deal with it pretty heavily. And it's something I definitely grew up with where there was no positive way to talk about my body ever. It was very much what Belen went through. So that was definitely a page out of my own book. I got hips, I got boobs really early in my life. And I think I've experienced a significant amount of trauma because of it. But it would be really interesting how like I'd go to my grandma's house and she was always like, oh my God, you just need to lose weight. Like my mom would be like, oh my God, you just need to lose weight. You need to lose weight. But I'd go out on the street and men would talk to me in ways that like to this day make my stomach turn. And it's fascinating to me. I wrote a line in there about the way Leti's mom talks about Belen's body of like, it's as though you're inviting them to talk to you. Though Belen is just existing, right? She's literally just waiting for the bus or walking to school.
And Leti's her best friend.
Yes. Yeah. Leti is her best friend. And I also wanted to parallel that with Leti. Leti's this very waif, thin girl, right? And I wanted to talk about the sexualization just based on these stereotypes around bodies. Belen is this very curvy Latina girl, and Latinas are often stereotyped as promiscuous in the media. And Belen is a virgin and is actively looking to lose her virginity. Her best friend is this thin girl with not a curve on her face and is pregnant their last year of high school. So I really wanted to flip that script, but also talk about how violent, how passively and but aggressively violent street harassment is.
You brought up Leti. Let's talk about Leti, Belen's best friend. Again, pregnant. She's Catholic. Her family's very religious.
Yeah.
And they're very racist. They're very anti-Black. Mm-hmm. And the father of her child is a Black classmate. Mm-hmm. And so you raise about anti-Blackness in the Latinx, Latino community. What inspired you to bring that up? And I'm glad there's more conversation about that, too, coming from folks.
You know, I've grown up in Oakland. I grew up in a very, what I'm learning now, you know, specifically talking to other friends and peers that I have, I grew up in a very traditional, like immigrant Mexican home. And unfortunately, what comes with traditionalism in the Mexican community is a large tie to Catholicism. that I think can be very dangerous, but also a large tie to like the caste system and to racism that has existed with colonization coming into Mexico forever ago. It's just, it's still in us, right? I had a very easy upbringing when it comes to race. Like, I'm a white Latina, I have green eyes. Things are just very, very easy for me. And they, at least in terms of racial appearance, they were always easy for me in my family. But as I, you know, continued growing up, as I did a lot of research, as I learned about the community, I learned how backwards that was, right? And specifically when I became a teacher, I started teaching an entirely Latino-Latina community, right? I only teach Latino students. And I just heard the way that parents would talk to their children. It was always within the community first. And it, that's what I put in the book. Like, Leti's family, before they're racist towards Quentin, are incredibly colorist toward her, right? And in the first chapter, they're like literally praying, like flipping her palms over, going, you know, she's going to wait in one day. And I've seen that happen in my family. And I've seen that happen in the context of my students, right? And it's a very sticky subject to correct because Mexican culture is very much like you respect your elders, you do not talk back, you do not question, right? But when your elders are saying things that are so backwards, then what do, right? So that was always hard for me as a teacher to walk the line between being respectful of everyone's parenting choices and attempting to correct and remedy the like very volatile racism coming out of a lot of parents' mouths, specifically to their children.
I grew up on like Babysitter's Club and Judy Blume. And now there's so much, you know, so much more that kids can access, you know, YA that's diverse. But still to this day, when I talk to you, they still don't know about books by authors of color. How, and you work in the school system, how do we get, and I ask this just about every author I talk to, how do we get these books to the young people in the schools, like books like yours?
It's really unfortunate. Lee and Lowe publishes data every year about the diversity in the publishing industry. And to this day in 2024, it's abysmal. Like, I think it's still 75, if not 70% of books are published by white authors, right? However, there are more books, right? Compared to when I grew up, I was reading in the 2010s and there was nothing like my book available to me, period. When I got back into reading YA in like 2018, 19, there suddenly seemed to be like a surge. However, I think we're seeing a new issue, right? Where we do have more books that are diverse in nature, but it is so hard to get kids to read now. And that's because of a number of things. We have a failing public education system that's been failing for a very long time. You would have thought the pandemic would get people to pick up the slack. It 100% didn't. It's also honestly way more fun to be online, right? We have kids who are online all the time. But going back to the root of the issue, which is our failing public ed system, I don't think we teach children how to read, period. Like, there's a lot of kids, unfortunately, like as a teacher today, we're in a major literacy crisis. Kids are leaving elementary school not knowing how to read.
Wow, really?
Really bad. Yeah, it's totally
bad. My goodness.
But the other piece is the students who are able to read and do have a sense of literacy by the time they're out of elementary school, for example, we're not teaching them to read for enjoyment. And that, I think, is a really large issue.
That was author Carolina Ixta speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Her book, Shut Up, This Is Serious, is now available in bookstores. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Next, we'll hear from another Bay Area author, Natasha Triplett, as part of New Arrivals, where we hear authors read from their new books. Natasha's new book explores Juneteenth and the family and community celebration that comes with it. Here she is reading from her book, Juneteenth Is.
This story celebrates Juneteenth with the reader through a community parade, a family barbecue, and finally a recounting of the importance of the holiday. Let me share with you a mouth-watering excerpt from the book. Juneteenth is generations of family recipes, secret rub on finger-licking chicken, juicy mouth-on-fire hot links, mac and cheese, collard greens, potato salad, smoky brisket, barbecue baked beans, honey cornbread, and stories from the past. Red in the sauce, red in the soda, red in the watermelon, red velvet cake, red in the suffering. Juneteenth is the history lesson not taught at school. Granddaddy's deep voice reminds us why we're here. It's not the slam of the dominoes or the slam dunk of the mac and cheese. Show was good though. It's about the door of opportunity no longer slamming in our faces.
That's author Natasha Triplett. And just a note, her writing studio is in a treehouse. Her book is Juneteenth Is. It came out last April. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and you can hear more from Bay Area writers at klw.org/newarrivals. Today's Cross Currents team includes Michaela Sia, Christopher Alam, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.